Welcome to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose Aguilar today. You might remember a stunning, appalling, indelible picture that shot around the world in September 2015. 2-year-old Alan Kurdi lying dead on a Turkish shore of the Mediterranean Sea. A massive humanitarian crisis of countless numbers distilled to one small, still, hopeless body. People around the world suddenly grasped how bad the crisis that was going on. This was the year the flow of refugees from war-ravaged countries into Europe reached a new peak. And it was 1 month after that horrible picture went viral that a massively overpacked, rusted, rotting tour boat went down off the shore of the island of Lesbos. As many as 300 people were suddenly in the cold, stormy waters. This hour, we're talking with journalist Jean Carstensen about her new book, A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. We're talking well beyond that time, too. 10 years have passed. Immigrants are still fighting to get out of dangerous areas into a safer, more secure life. But politics have changed. The wave of conservatism across the West has surfaced anti-immigrant hatred. Resources, even in generous regions, are straining servicing new immigrants. Welcome signs are being pulled down. EU countries are wrangling over new policies. Greece's pumped-up border protection produced a 30% drop in new migrants since last year. But last week, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced plans to send new migrants back to Greece. Let's go back to 2015 and forward into what's in store for newcomers as politics continue to shift. Jean Carstensen's work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Policy, The World, The Nation, and others. She's covered the Syrian refugee crisis in Greece and Turkey with support from the Pulitzer Center. Her work was shortlisted for the Immigration Journalism Awards. Jean, a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Angie. Thank you.
Help us out with a picture of the immigrant crisis in 2015. Who was on the move toward Europe and why?
It was Syrians primarily because the Syrian civil war was in its fourth year at that point, and they were trying to get to safety in Europe. It was also around 25% Afghans. Afghanistan has been in constant war and instability for about three decades. And then people from all over the Middle East and some as far away as Bangladesh and Northern Africa.
Was Greece bearing the brunt of this along with Italy? Was this mostly a matter of geography, or did politics figure into to where the migrants would try to go?
Well, it's a combination, but certainly geography is core. If you look at the map and see how close Turkey is to the islands of Greece in the Eastern Aegean, it's just about to Lesbos, about 6 miles, and there's other islands like Chios and Kos that are also very close. And so the borders from Turkey into Bulgaria had been hardened, and also into Greece. There is a land and river border in the north that had also been hardened. And so at that time, smugglers opened up this route that had always been there, but it became like a massive highway run by smugglers for refugees trying to reach Europe. And they came across mainly to Lesbos, but also to these other islands. And it was about 1 million people that year.
In fact, I'm going to glance ahead a little bit and talk about just how saturated in politics the picture is, because late in the book, you're talking about when the crisis is underway and people are being pulled out of the water. Like all fishermen in the area, I'm quoting from the book, Turkish or Greek, they knew the location of the sea border very well because they weren't permitted to cross it. Geopolitical rivals Greece and Turkey have fought for decades over unresolved issues in the Aegean regarding territory, airspace, and resources. So we have this picture of people who are so saturated in the politics that as they're pulling human bodies out of the water, they're keeping an eye on how safe they are being on this side or that side of this political line.
It's true. And when I first visited the island in 2012 as a tourist, I looked out at this beautiful sea across to Turkey. And of course, you don't see an international border and you don't think about it. But out in the sea, there is this line. And in 2015, it became, imagine it was like the finish line for people trying to get inside the EU. But the Greek and Turkish fishermen, they live all the time around this border and they know they're not supposed to cross over. For the Turks, the cost could have been very, very high. Two fishing boats from Turkey responded. They crossed over into Greece, and tensions were so high at that time, it was quite common for the Greek Coast Guard to accuse any Turk, anybody at all, of being a smuggler. And so they wanted to save lives. They followed their hearts to do so, but they were taking a big risk.
Let's set the stage a bit as to what was happening prior to this particular boat sinking, because boats were coming in every day. And you write that on the day of the shipwreck, more than 6,500 refugees had landed on Lesbos. The next day, another 6,500, then the next day and the next. More than 130,000 refugees arrived in October alone, almost 500,000 by the end of the year. What did that look? You were there. What did that look like as people came in on these daily boats?
I'm so glad you asked that. It was really astounding to be there as a journalist and stand on these shores. And every day you're seeing 6,000 new people. And as a journalist, you get a chance to talk to people. And everybody arrived filled with hopes and dreams. And if they arrived safely, many of the people just crumpled up on the beach and cried or thanked God or prayed because they were so happy to survive and they had crossed this barrier and they were on their way to Europe. It's hard to describe what it's like to have so many people going through a beautiful rustic area with only small villages. And that's in part why I wrote the book, because it was so moving to see all these newcomers and then to see the locals try and deal with something that it was just like the world opened up and from one day to the next brought this humanitarian crisis to their shores. And the reactions were mixed, but on a person-to-person level, I did see, a lot of people just handing out water or doing simple things, but the whole coastline was like a, if you've seen pictures, say, of a large parade. I mean, even think of the gay parade in San Francisco and Market Street is packed. It's sort of like the little rustic shoreline road was packed every day with people from dozens of countries. It was astounding.
And you talk about a number of the people in the book. You track four particular migrants who did make it out of the shipwreck we're about to discuss. And I think that there's one particular person in that group who shatters some of our delusions or our misapprehension about who these folks are. Hedayat Habibyar was an Afghan bank loan officer. This is not a man who's just looking for a better life because, oh, well, life's better on the other side. He's a loan officer. He's not, his neighborhood isn't war-torn. His house isn't being bombed. And we have this idea that everyone from a war-torn country is in that kind of desperation. His desperation was personal. He fought back against fraud at the bank. He came up against the powers that be. His life was threatened. Rezwada Sekindari, she was only 13, but her father was a journalist. He had to get out because his work was dangerous. And I think that as you describe this picture of so many people arriving at the shoreline, yes, some of them were escaping a devastation we visualize in bombed out areas, but others, well, each story is unique.
You're exactly right. And so the four people I profile, two coming from Syria and two coming from Afghanistan, of course, they all were escaping war and instability in one way or another. But when you drill down into each individual story, it doesn't mean, as you say, that the bomb literally landed on their house. Society falls apart in a multitude of ways that make it unsafe for people to stay there. And so, yes, the two Afghans, Hidayat, who was a loan officer at a bank, and Rizwana, this girl, Her father, a journalist, he worked for One TV, which was an independent television station in Afghanistan at the time, because you have to remember, independent media then was thriving. But the Taliban was coming back and they had targeted particularly One TV, and Rezwana's father felt it was no longer safe for him to stay. And so, yes, they had means. And at this time, a lot of the people crossing the Aegean had means because it was very expensive, Angie. It's incredible. I've taken that ferry back and forth between Turkey and Lesbos. Maybe some of your listeners have. It's beautiful between Ayvalık and Mytilene, and it costs about 15 euros. But they were not able to board a ferry, and so they had to turn to smugglers. And to get in a dinghy was about $1,000 a person. And the boat that I write about, which was a wooden boat, and the smugglers charged more, pretended that it was going to be safer, $2,500 per person. So people were not dirt poor. They had enough means to be on the move.
You talk about some of the locals who had already established themselves as part of the rescue teams for the daily incoming boats. Talk about Kostas Pinter, because we meet him in this idyllic moonlit floating out there on the deck of his boat. He's out there trying to get some calamari. He loves the water. He loves his life. And yet he's already wrapped the rescue of the refugees into his daily life.
Exactly. The Coast Guard was so overwhelmed with so many people coming. And as September turned into October, there were more stormy days and the seas were rougher. And so there were more dinghies and sometimes wooden boats getting into trouble out there. And if they were inside Greek waters, it was the responsibility of the Greek Coast Guard to respond to these accidents. Well, they only had two boats, if you can believe it, two patrol boats that were available for this, and they were completely overwhelmed. And so they had Kostas and other fishermen on speed dial. And in fact, that scene that you're referring to at the beginning of the boat, it was 2 a.m., the morning of October 28th, and his cell phone buzzed. They asked him to help, told him generally where they think the incident was, and he headed out on his little wooden boat and found a sunken dinghy, and he rescued these people. And he and other Greek fishermen, and also some Turkish fishermen on that side, they did this time and time and time again. And a few of them became official heroes, but most of these acts went uncommented upon or unnoticed. And that was another motivation for me to write the book, because it was pretty moving to see this.
Not everyone who was pitching in to help out got unanimous praise. You introduced us to Melinda McCroskey. She owned a local restaurant. She had already started a volunteer foundation to help out the incoming refugees. And her days were very busy with running her own business at the same time she was trying to provide food and sandwiches and blankets, but she didn't receive unanimous support from local residents, even her own neighbors, and certainly the wider community. They were not all together in supporting the refugees.
Absolutely. This is in the town of Molivos. And Molivos, if anybody's been to the island, it's very beautiful with a Ottoman castle up on the cliffs above the town, and it's a very beautiful place to visit, and they have a lot of restaurants, and she ran one of them. So when the refugees started coming earlier that year, yeah, she was involved with the Greek equivalent of PTA. She wasn't particularly political, but for whatever reason, she just felt like, okay, I'll start making sandwiches. We can give them some clothes and some hot tea. And as more and more people came, this just got bigger and bigger, and it did start to cause tensions in the community. And she had some locals who came down and really wanted to help from the upper village. People live up high and they could sort of ignore it if they wanted. But as time went by, a lot of people who were involved in tourism, they really felt that it was destroying their business, and there was open anti-migrant sentiment. And some of this was turned against Melinda and her husband, Theo. And the night of the shipwreck, Theo, for instance, he there were not enough medics to deal with all of the hypothermic children that were being rescued. And somebody asked him to hold this little girl. We don't know what country she was from. He ran and held her with his heater going on in the car, and finally was able to give her to an ambulance. But later that evening, a man that was a friend of his said some very racist things. Basically, why are you doing this, buddy? Why are you helping these horrible people? And so all of these things were in play in 2015.
You know, there's this, unfortunately, we make ourselves happy thinking that children bring us all together. But when you have a child who's near death in a situation like that, and one of your neighbors goes off talking about, why are you helping these people? You know, it's sad to understand that that's part of human nature as well.
You're right. Although I do have to say, in terms of children, you're right that there does tend to be, if anything is going to bring people together, it's children. And one thing that was moving that night is to see how instinctively, because there was no overall rescue plan, the Coast Guard was not in communication with UNHCR, that was in communication with the Spanish lifeguards who were out there. It was all very seat of the pants, this whole rescue that went on that day. But instinctively, the fishermen, the lifeguards, the Coast Guard, they did rescue the children first, and it was in general something that brought people together. But that example does show that even with children, people can grow cold and lose their humanity. And that's what that terrible comment shows. Luckily, that was not what dominated that night.
That's Jean Carstensen. She's with us here on Your Call to talk about her book, A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. We talked a little bit, Jean, about the smugglers. Let's go back to who they are, whether they're just in it for the money. Are they organized? Are they of one group? Are they individuals, you know, rugged individuals doing it on their own? Who are the smugglers?
It is a very big international network. It's very big business, and it's run up top by people that you never know who are running a billion-dollar people moving operation. But when you get down to the people that most of the refugees are in contact with, there's all kinds of people. I have interviewed smugglers who have gotten out of the business and were willing to share their perspectives with me. And one Turkish smuggler told me that actually he believed that most of the people were ruthless and just cared about money more than anything else. This is often in economically challenged areas. This is a very, very good way to make money. But he said there were people involved who actually wanted to help the smugglers. And I think something that, I'm sorry, that there were people involved who actually wanted to help the refugees and wanted to play a small part, make money, but also cared to some extent that they got there safely. That's how the person I spoke to portrayed himself. But then if you get even further down, like on the Turkish coast, I interviewed locals and some of the fishermen, and they described that whether they wanted to or not, you know, it happened on the Greek side that everybody landed there. But what happened on the Turkish side was that all of the villages on that side were just taken over by the smuggling operation, whether they wanted to or not. And it was so vast that some of the locals, very average people who were probably not involved with this before, they got involved that year because they could make, you know, $1,000 a day letting smugglers use the beach by their restaurant, or they could make $1,000 loading people onto boats. So it's a very mixed panorama. But what drives it really is our failed policies. And you will see today that in our policies and EU policies, there's a lot of focus on the fact that if you help refugees, you're actually inviting them to come. And this is not true. And a lot of money is being spent with the idea that we're going to stop the smuggling networks all around the world, and that will solve our problems, and people won't be able to reach Europe, and the refugees won't be taken advantage of. But the people in 2015, that period, those people mostly fleeing war and instability, they were very smart people. I think if we were in their shoes, we would have done the same thing. We needed to get to safety. Europe, none of those countries would give people travel visas. So there was no way for them, they could afford to fly. That's the irony. They could afford to fly. It would, in fact, have been cheaper to fly. Hidayat could have afforded to fly his family from Kabul and go right to Munich, say, or Berlin, and ask for asylum or ask for a temporary work permit or some, legal way to stay in the country. But that was not an option for 99% of the people. They were all coming from countries whose visas were not being accepted. And so, because of this chaotic mixed message, where on the one hand, Germany and other countries are saying, "We recognize you're war refugees. We have an obligation to help you." And that was a signal to them that they have a good chance of getting asylum there. But there was no way for them to get there legally. And so it's crazy. I remember thinking at the time, looking out, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing in 2015 in this beautiful part of the world. And this could have been centuries ago. That people are having to cross in boats to get from one continent to another, even though we live in modern times, they had to do this and turn to smugglers because there was no legal way for them to begin this process.
And you can see when you have all those people on foot, you have an 8 month pregnant woman who's, walking 35 miles on foot with her children with her and her husband with her. You can see how the smugglers distance themselves from the humanity there. At one point, a smuggler refers to the games. Escaping by boat is a water game. It's really discomforting to read that.
Yes, and that was the slang that my Hidayat, the Afghan banker, who told me his story, his whole trip in incredible detail. And he explained that the slang with the Afghan smugglers, who they called it the game. And I know from, other Afghans I've spoken to and books that I've read that that is a common phrase. And it sounds very ironic, the game. It's not a game at all, but that's sort of the slang that they use. So they would refer to a water game. That meant, crossing by sea, or a land game. Or when Hidayat and his family had to make the very rough and dangerous crossing through the mountains between Iran and into Turkey, and it was very hard. That's what you're referring to. The smuggler said, "Oh, these games happen all the time." But I think they know that it's very serious. It's just the slang that they use.
You're listening to Your Call. We're going to take a brief break here and come back with Jean Carstensen about her book, A Greek Tragedy, One Day, a Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. In a little while, we'll be talking too about the current picture for migrants trying to move from difficult areas into the EU and, in fact, across to America, where Donald Trump has just issued another edict about who can come and who can't. Coming back just after this break, I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose Aguilar.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero. Jean Carstensen is my guest. We're talking in particular about a shipwreck that took place outside of the Greek island of Lesbos, and the all-hands-on-deck response from the locals and the authorities in the area to try to get hundreds of people out of the water. So, Jean, let's talk about this boat. And it's very sad to know that even very intelligent people, for example, one of the folks you focus on is a Syrian physiologist. He's a school counselor. He's no dummy. But his desperation is such that he allows himself to believe he's going to have a private room on what's essentially a tour boat. And when everyone arrives, not only are there literally hundreds more people than they expected to see because of this private boat, there's also the fact that it's a rusting hulk of what used to be a respectable boat.
Exactly. You know, that you're referring to Okba Bahadır, and he came to Istanbul. He left Syria and he was trying to get to Europe, and he was introduced to an Iraqi smuggler in Istanbul who showed him a photo. He pulled out a photo of a white yacht, this gleaming white yacht with round portholes, and said, "Listen, Okba, it's not exactly this boat, but it's somewhat like this." And Okba is a very educated man and trained in psychology, and he sort of was battling with himself at the time, and he knew the guy was probably lying, but he thought even if half of it was true. And he's a very large man, obese, he's 470 pounds. And so the idea of being on a safe boat and having his own room was really, really appealing to him. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something, Angie, I felt time and time again with him and with other people that I spoke to, I could see how I would do the same thing. You know, it's not like he believed every single word, but you want to believe the best, and you want to believe that you have found a smuggler that really cares and that you're going to pay this money. And, you know, maybe they're ripping you off a little bit, but it'll make you safer. But even that falls apart generally when they get to the coast and see, you know, they got there and this was no gleaming yacht. It was a double-decker boat that had been pulled out of a boat graveyard. When I interviewed the fishermen in Turkey who had actually seen this boat, they told me it wasn't from there. It's probably from up near Istanbul. And back in the day, it was used for weddings and graduations, mm-hmm. you know, double-decker, and people would be dancing up top with traditional music and probably drinking rakı. But that was a long time ago. And by the time they brought this boat, it was rusted. The railings were rusted. The sealant was off of the wood, and also the upper deck. It was only supported by these four poles that had not been maintained, and so it was not a safe boat at all. And the other factor that day was gale force winds, and the smugglers knew those winds were blowing out in the middle of the channel.
I think it's easy to say from a distance, well, you know, if I were in that situation, I'd see that boat and I just wouldn't get on. The smugglers they're armed and they're threatening people to get on the boat. They've already got their money. One person or another on that boat you would think wouldn't make any difference to them. Why do they threaten violence to get the people to get on the boat?
They need to have these boats packed to keep the money flowing. And if they let people turn around and change their mind, it would be chaotic. So they do a good sell job when you meet them in Izmir or Istanbul. But once you are sort of under their care, or your trip has begun, then they take control of the group. And a lot of the things that they have told you individually don't turn out to be true. And I tell you, they will not let people turn around. This is a different story, not to do with this boat, but another boat around that same time. A woman, just as the boat was loading in Turkey, she was having some kind of heart attack or heart event. Mm-hmm. And her husband begged them, please, let me get off, let me find healthcare. They would not. And so when this boat arrived to Lesbos, it's a traumatic story. When it arrived, this woman was dead in the middle of the raft. Mm. And so they have weapons, and there is absolutely no way for these people to turn around at this point.
So we've got this far overpacked. You can't exaggerate how overpacked it was. It's riding low in the water because of all the weight, and it starts to pull out. What was the weather like out there?
It was very windy. These are known as Mount Ida winds. They come from the northwest, and they're very common that time of year. And they're not called this, but these northwesterly winds are referred to by Homer in the Iliad. It's a very known weather pattern in that part of the world. And because of the mountains in Turkey, they block this wind. So the people in the port where the boat left from, it was a small village called Sivriche, it was calm there. And it was also very sunny. And so that gave them temporary confidence. But everybody, the fishermen and the smugglers and the people in Lesvos, they knew very well that out in the channel, it was very, very windy. And these winds, it was also very windy over on the Lesvos side because it's not so protected by this wind. And so when they got out there, it was gale force winds. And, the waves were like 6 and 7 feet high and very choppy. That's how people who know the Mediterranean, it's not like big waves coming through, but it's a very choppy, dangerous situation with gale force winds. And so that wasn't the only factor, but that was one of the factors that led to this tragedy.
And there were observers on the other side who saw this bizarre sight of all these people on this sinking boat. And suddenly it just vanishes from sight. And on the boat, it's literally collapsing. It's, the nails are pulling out of the wood, and the upper deck is collapsing onto the lower deck. And it's chaos.
It is chaos. It's true chaos. I interviewed two fishermen in Turkey who saw the boat leave. So they had seen many, many rafts. They had seen tens of thousands of people leaving in that September and that October because their village was right in the center of this trafficking that was going on. But this was the biggest boat they had seen, and this was the most people on one boat, and they knew about the winds, the gale force winds, and so they begged the smugglers, and they knew one of them because one of them was a Turkish fisherman who turned into a smuggler, and they begged him, "Do not send this boat out. It is not safe." And sure enough, the smugglers did not listen to them, of course, and the boat left. And people described it as sort of a monstrosity. I described it, like almost some sort of an iceberg-like shape, which is an odd image because it's warm weather, but it was so crowded with people, they said that you couldn't really see the boat. It was like a mountain of people going out. And the Turkish fishermen followed it with their binoculars. And it's one moment it was there and one moment it was gone. And the other thing I was able to do is, of course, on the Greek side in Lesvos, many, many people were up on the cliffs with their binoculars, and they had also spotted this boat. Because on the Greek side, every day there were volunteers up there and they would try and see how many boats were coming so they could be prepared to greet them. And so they had noticed this one big boat and they were very worried because it was so stormy. And it was the same thing. They're following it, and all of a sudden it's just gone. And the next thing they see out in the water is almost like an oil slick of blue and orange, and that's the people in their life jackets. And I wish I could tell you that everybody had life jackets on. They didn't. And in fact, Hidayat and his family, the banker from Kabul, and his sons were only 2 and 3 years old. His wife was pregnant. Well, their smugglers told them the boat was so safe, they didn't need life jackets. And the other thing that people may remember from the reporting of the period is that many of the life jackets that people bought at that time were fake life jackets being manufactured. They would sell them as if they were real and people would pay full price, but these were cheaply manufactured. They looked great, they were bright orange, and they had some brand on there, but the foam was fake foam and it wasn't really flotation foam. And so when it got heavy, it could even be bad. And so it was terrible. And the winds and the currents out there are so strong. You know, almost imagine like the Golden Gate. It's not that far across. But would you want to be out there in the middle of it with those kind of currents? That's what it was like on that day. It was very scary, and the slick was getting bigger and bigger. And I was on the cliffs as a journalist, so I saw a little bit of this after. I didn't see it sink, but many people saw it, but nobody really knew much about the boat because it sank so quickly. It totally sank. And it was not until years later that I went to Turkey and found the exact village where the boat left from, and was able to interview these Turks who saw it, that I was able to get such an in-depth description. There is some footage of it because of one woman who was on the boat who I interview. Maybe you want to talk about Amel, who was wearing a waterproof camera.
Please tell us more about her.
Yes, Amel, 27 at the time, and she was living in Istanbul and couldn't go back to Syria because she had been involved in resistance movements. And of course, Assad was targeting anybody. She could have easily been, she had already been targeted in Syria one time that she was visiting there and had gotten a warning from the secret police. And, you know, they imprison people and they're never seen again. So she couldn't go backwards. She decided she wanted to go on to Germany and join her husband, who had gone a few months ahead of her. And she tried several times to get a visa. She couldn't get a visa. She was trained as a journalist, but really wanted to be an artist. And her filmmaker husband had left some of his camera equipment behind. And so she decided to bring a small waterproof camera that she wore on her wrist. And of course, she had no idea she'd be involved in a tragedy like this, but she wanted to just wear it and leave it on so that she could share the footage and her experience later when she joined her husband in Syria. And it turned out that this footage documented this whole journey, and she went on to make her own movie about it, a personal documentary. It's a, I guess I would describe it as an experimental documentary. And also, she shared the footage with Forensic Architecture, a human rights organization in London, that they used that footage to do an investigation about the shipwreck. So again, not the kind of person. She's college educated, was traveling with her college educated friend, and the two of them survived this, but it was very, very traumatic for them. But thanks to this footage, that was another way in which I was able to get details about what happened, details of what the boat looked like, and allowed me to, you know, to write about the shipwreck the way I did.
Well, as you write about it, you talk too about the terrible dilemma of the people who go out there and rescue. For one thing, it's the sheer size of what's going on. It's the sheer number of people. This is not an overstuffed dinghy with 60 people. We're talking hundreds of people. There are volunteers who are out there on jet skis, and they realize very quickly they're looking around at bodies and people crying for help, and they have to triage on the spot. I will save this person. I will have to let this person die.
Yeah, it was very traumatic for them. These were four Spanish lifeguards who had just arrived to the island from Barcelona a few weeks ago, and they realized there's no lifeguards, there's no trained people helping with this humanitarian disaster. So they jumped in on their own initiative, and they had just gotten two jet skis. So the four men, two on each jet skis, they had to go several miles that day in this very stormy weather to reach the area of the shipwreck. And when they got there, they just couldn't believe what it looked like to them was there had been a plane crash. because there was no boat, and you could kind of imagine it was so vast. And people were drowning, they were struggling, there were already empty life jackets. They started to realize, oh gosh, an empty life jacket, that means somebody has already drowned. Now, the Greek Coast Guard was there, but there were only two patrol boats, and these boats sit very high in the water. They're not really made for this kind of rescue situation, so they were marginally effective. And what the jet skis, these guys were right close to the water and close to the people. So, as you say, they had to pick who to save first. And they followed their gut instinct and they just decided, we're saving the children first. And so a lot of times what they did was they would, see, say, a parent, a man or a woman holding a child, they would take the child thinking they'll come back for the parent. Now, why do you save a child? In part, there's something in human nature. We think we got to save the child, but also it's because they're more at risk. Hypothermia, the smaller you are, they're small bodies, it can take your life much more quickly than an adult. And the kids don't know how to swim and all those factors. So they would rush these children to either the fishing boat. Many fishing boats came, about nine, seven from Lesbos and two from Turkey, or to the Coast Guard. And they would give these kids up to the Coast Guard and then they would go back out. And one of the real tragedies, Angie, was several times they realized they couldn't find the parents again. And after this whole ordeal was over, it did turn out that there were quite a number of orphan children. And it was also so hard on these lifeguards because before this, none of them had been trained. They were not humanitarian workers. They were beach lifeguards. Like they knew how to save people's lives, in Catalonia during the summer or during a surfing competition, but they had not been in the midst of a humanitarian crisis like this. And so it just, all of them, they're out there and they look and it reminds them of their own children. And another decision that they had to make is if they saw somebody who was face down in the water, they would have to let them go and assume they were dead. And that was very hard for them because oftentimes, if there had been many, many lifeguards, you would have time to pull that person out of the water and they have the skills to revive the person. But they didn't have time. And so that's where the triage came in. And all of these decisions, and they weren't even decisions, they were just gut actions. It was eating them up inside. But these four lifeguards, they saved many, many, many lives that day, as did the Coast Guard and the Frontex ship. But had the lifeguards not been there down close to, and pulling people out like that, many, many more people would have drowned.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave the story of the shipwreck itself there. Jean Carstensen has it all documented in her book, A Greek Tragedy: One Day, a Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. I guarantee you it is a story worth reading to the very end. Jean, I want to talk about what has happened since then in terms of two things. One is the actual physical situation of the smugglers and the boats and whether anyone ever paid any price for what happened that night. What is the story of the effect of this shipwreck and others like it on the quote-unquote industry of smuggling?
I don't think that there's really any cost to the smugglers whatsoever. Occasionally, people get arrested. From this particular incident, a low-level smuggler who was involved in taking somebody's money and arranging for a family to be on this particular boat, he was found and served jail time in Germany. But the overall structure and the industry has not been impacted, and there has not been any real accountability for that shipwreck or for any of the other shipwrecks. It's very rare. Every once in a while, authorities will catch a somebody driving the boat in the central Mediterranean or maybe there who is a legitimate smuggler, and this person will get put into jail. But more times than not, what the smugglers do is they get off the boats before they're anywhere near authorities, and they force people who don't know what they're doing to pilot the boat. That's what happened that day. The smugglers had jumped off before they got to the international border, and they had gone back to Turkey, leaving this overloaded boat with somebody who 5 minutes ago they said, "Here, you drive this," and in the midst of gale force winds. And that was another factor as to why the boat sank, because people don't know basic things about how to, point the boat into the waves and not let it hit the boat sideways, and all these kinds of things. Now, what's happening, Angie, is they often authorities are going to accuse humanitarian workers of being smugglers. At that time, in 2015, it was almost like the Burning Man of helping. Everybody you could imagine from all over the world showed up on that island and other islands, and they had different levels of training, but they were trying to help. That has been largely shut down, and now whenever they can, the Greek government is going after humanitarian workers, and they're doing this in the Central Med. The lifeguards that I mentioned, they now have a huge NGO called Open Arms, and they're one of the sea rescue NGOs operating between Libya and Italy, out in the much even more dangerous Central Med. And Italy and other countries has put regulations doing everything they can to try and make it impossible for them to rescue people out there. And they Gerard, one of the Spanish lifeguards who saved so many lives on October 28th, he later was accused of being a smuggler by the Italians, because that's the argument they have, that they're in cahoots, with the refugees and the smugglers, and they're somehow making money. And there's never any proof of this, and but they continue to try and block people from being able to help.
At the same time, things are changing on the international picture. Last week, the migration minister in Greece said that Greece is going to end mass legalization programs for migrants. He's going to jail those awaiting deportation. There are tougher policies coming into effect this summer. Migrants with rejected asylum claims will face a minimum of 2 years in jail. And then, we have Germany who's saying they're going to start pushing migrants back to Greece and leaving them to deal with it. This sounds like it's being echoed largely all over the West.
I think so. I was going to say it sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds familiar to what's happening here. It's very sad. It is the politics of our time. It ignores a problem that is not going to go away. I don't see how it benefits society to take people who are trying to work in a given country and sometimes follow whatever the procedures are to eventually get legal status in the country and jail them. There is a phrase in Greece that I heard on the island called that says, "You can't stop water or people." And it's just, shorthand for saying that migration is it's a universal human experience. We can look right now, and there's certainly reasons why a lot of people are on the move, but humans have always been on the move. And so I find it just horrifying that we are turning our backs on people who really need help, and we seem to be not anymore responding to the human rights obligations that have been agreed upon by so many countries following World War II. And these are eroding very, very quickly. And it's sad, and so many people's human rights are being violated, and so many just average people are going to suffer because of this.
We've got a caller who's been waiting. Catherine, I appreciate your patience there in Menlo Park. You're on the air on your call.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's truly tragic, and it's overwhelming. And you can certainly see how all the resentment is being built up around the amount of the flow of people. But I really feel like the focus is lost on where the issue is coming from and who benefits. So transnational corporations can move around labor and markets and with the blink of an eye and exploit labor wherever they want in the world. In the meantime, the people are being restricted more and more. You know, they're just the people who live in these countries where we're exploiting only have so many options. And when those options go away, where are they going to go, you know, for to make a living? And I feel like we're living in this world where it's accepted that there are no borders in terms of technology and markets, and yet I believe that the corporations should be held accountable for what the situation that they have created and maintained, and that you know, we're looking in the wrong place. We're putting the blame on the people and the nations that have no power in the situation, because the power lies with the states and the companies that control the money and.
And let me take that over to our guest, Catherine. I thank you for the call. Jean, this is stuff that you have definitely touched on, and it's interesting. Some things are simply chaotic and out of everyone's control, and some part of this is very much controlled.
Yes, but I really agree with what the caller said. I think that's true, that we have freedom of capital and technology, but yet the human capital is being manipulated all the time. I think that is a really good point. And also that you talk about the source of the problem, you know, look at the war in Iraq and the chaos that led to in the region that is still playing out. And all of these policies and government actions are often at the root of why people are on the move. So I couldn't agree more that we have to keep that in mind. And on Lesbos, I remember the local people just screaming sometimes, stop the war, stop the war. You know, they weren't focused on the migrants. They could understand, stop the war. And if you stop the war, then the people will not be coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jean Carstensen, I thank you so much for spending an hour with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jean Carstensen's book is A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. She covered the Syrian refugee crisis in Greece and Turkey with support from the Pulitzer Center. Her work has been shortlisted for the Immigration Journalism Awards. If you missed any part of our show, there are two ways to hear it. It will be rebroadcast tonight here on KALW at 7 p.m. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit kalw.org/yourcall. You can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. With show ideas or feedback, drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org, or call us 866-798-8255. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.